Okay, let me start by welcoming you all here to Vanderbilt University. For those who are visiting and for those who live and work here, have more pizza and relax, and we'll send you off in a second. Imagine, if you will, for 1 second, that student you see walking down the hallway. You know, that one that you see more of his underwear than you see of his pants in the back, and the shoes are untied and the laces are flapping behind him. And no, I'm not talking about anybody in here. And they got the big jacket on, whether it's 80 degrees outside or minus 40 degrees outside. He's got the brand new hat on with the stickers inside of it and the logos hanging out of it. And they got the jewelry and the bling bling going on, and he turns a corner and it's a white kid. Y'all weren't ready for that, was you? In your mind's eye, you saw this black male walking down the street, walking down the campus. And it really, what does that make you think? What does that make you feel? Why is this person dressing what we as adults seem to chastise constantly? There's not many kids today who walk around that way without some adult somewhere asking them about their dress and their attire. Historically, when we look at the way people dress, the music they listen to, the things they do, we can clearly see that this has been going on in youth generations throughout the time. In the 50s, it was the DAs with the leather jackets and the t-shirts and the sleeves rolled up and the cigarettes rolled up in here and jeans and all that. That was rebel culture, if you will. In the 70s, I remember everything was red, black, and green and afros and platform shoes and dog-eared, and that was the style. That's what was going on. As we went through that integration period of Brown v. Board of Education in the 50s, which didn't really take effect until the 80s, we started reversing that process ever since then. There have been other certain circumstances and situations that have also been accompanying that reverse of being able to be a youth, have that rebel kind of culture, and then transition into adulthood. What we have now is that we have some youth who are getting stuck in that youth culture, youth look, 30, 40, 50 years old, still wearing same throwback jerseys and baggy pants. And the problem with that is that society looks down upon that. So when we're getting ready to hire somebody, they don't look a certain role, they don't get hired. And even if they do get hired because somehow or another they get past looking a certain role, then we find out that soft discrimination, those other things play majorly into, have a major impact on success of the student or the adult's career. Now, before I go any further, I learned a word while doing my dissertation, and I know I haven't introduced us yet, but that's coming. But I want to get the stuff out of the way. By way of housekeeping, if anything happens, you need to get out of here quickly. Come in the way you go out, the way you came in. Follow me. Just don't get in my way. Delimitation was a word I learned during my dissertation. Anybody know delimitation? Delimitation was a great word to learn. It's a word I'll give to you. Keep it. Write it down. Use it whenever you want. It basically says what you will not be doing. Okay? Because oftentimes we come to presentations, meetings, convocations, whatever, and we expect panacea. We expect cure-alls. But the word delimitation means basically what I'm not going to do. For example, I just jotted some down while I was listening. This presentation will not or is not intended to answer all questions. So I know you're going to leave out here and say, well, I didn't have this question answered. We understand that. Up front, you won't get them all. Also, solve all problems. If we could do that, we're in the wrong house. We need to be in a White House somewhere if we could solve all problems. Make you feel good. This is not designed to make everybody feel good. A lot of times folks walk out of here very disgruntled. I just talked to a couple of teachers and administrators from the school system here in Nashville who saw me present at the Moving On conference, and one word a teacher just told me, she said, shook things up. You know, folks were upset. And I said, well, it wasn't my intention, so maybe I should have put a disclaimer or, you know, delimitation on that presentation as well. But what I did speak from research, and I did speak from my heart. And sometimes people have problems with that because they just want to hear the research. And then also challenge everyone. We know that we have access to the same information you have. If you have an internet, if you have some time on your hands and you have drive, you can find out everything myself and my colleague have found out for you. You couldn't. But because you have your full-time jobs and our job is a little different, we kind of consolidate this information and give it to a larger audience. That way you don't have to go out and get it. And it also gives you fodder for your cannons when you want to go and make changes in your own areas of expertise. Now, let's tell you what we won't do. I'll tell you what we will do. What we will do is to update some folks who were here last week. This is an ongoing project that we're running. And we had a little bit of publicity over the last couple of weeks. And because of that, we moved from the Warren Center right next door over here because we were warned that there may be 60 or 70 school teachers coming. So we wanted to open that up so we could have those folks come in. All right? And we didn't have food for them, but we said first come, first serve. So if everybody here is munching or drinking, then good. I'm glad you got here. My name is Gil Whiting. I'm on faculty here at Vanderbilt University. My building's right next door, Buttrick Hall. I'm the director of undergraduate studies for the program in African American Diaspora Studies, and I also teach in Peabody College of Education, Human Organizational Development. I don't want to say that again. My colleague is Dr. Donna Ford. She's the Betts Chair of Education at Peabody College of Education, as well as a renowned scholar on gifted education for underrepresentation of minority students in the field. So what we're going to do today is give you an overview of our lecture series that we've started some time ago, and we'll move on from there. You want to talk?
Okay.
Try to hold those together.
All righty. I don't think this is on. Can you hear? Is this on?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Today we're going to be talking about Acting White and Acting Black, a study of peer pressures and achievement attitudes and behaviors among highly capable African-American students. But before we do that, for those of you who were not here on September the 11th when we did the initial seminar, we wanted to give you an overview of the purpose of this project that we're working on. So the study will come after I kind of give you a brief overview, and trying to work with about 6 or 7 minutes with this overview. We want to show you our visual of what we're calling the Vanderbilt Achievement Gap Project. So the purpose of the project, including this seminar, is to focus on theory, research, policy, and practice as it relates to closing the achievement gap. We have been looking at a number of variables related to the achievement gap. For example, we talk about the concentric rings of influence in our research, and one of the rings is related to family, culture, community. In other words, what is going on in our homes and in our communities that contributes to and or exacerbates the achievement gap. And there are a number of variables. We also have been looking at more specifically what's going on in the schools in terms of teacher quality, instructional strategies, lack of teacher diversity, materials, and again, you know, 15, 16, 100 other variables we need to look at in terms of what contributes to the achievement gap. So for those of you who are here as parents, you know, definitely think about what is going on in the home. For those of you who are here as educators, you know, think about what's going on in the schools and then the overlap of those two. The other ring that we look at is social. And social is basically divided into two areas. We're interested in what's going on with the peer culture, which is a major part of what we're going to be talking about today, and also the larger issues, the societal issues, including discrimination, for example, against African American, or issues of poverty. So the bigger picture is social, but includes peer pressures. And then finally, we're looking at what's going on with the children themselves in terms of their self-esteem, their self-concept, their racial identity, and other kinds of variables, their need for achievement, their need for affiliation. And our argument is that unless we look at those four concentric rings of influence and all the many variables that go under there, we're going to have a difficult time closing the gap. So we have this project that we're looking at in terms of the Vanderbilt Achievement Gap Project, looking at how we, from various disciplines, from various walks of life, can come in and really take a look at these concentric rings of influence. We also are borrowing from the work of Barton of ETS, from his report, Parsing the Achievement Gap, looking at how the achievement gap does start early. Before children even begin school, there is an achievement gap, all right? And again, that's the home and the community, that particular ring right there. And just as important, we're looking at what goes on during school and after school, okay? Well, one thing we do want to say is that the research is clear, the achievement gap begins early in school, but it actually increases during school.
Okay, just to give you an overview really quickly, we went through this again 2 weeks ago, and so for those who are kind of, what Dr. Ford also talked about was that we are actually establishing or building a cadre of folks that can actually do something. So more so than just continue to present the information of things that we're finding, we're actually looking for active researchers who are interested in doing things to be a part of the information gathering, if you will. So graduate students, other professors, faculty, teachers, whoever in the community who's interested in doing more of this are also encouraged to participate on a higher level. Now, Dr. Ford mentioned Barton's ETS research from a couple years ago, and this is a meta-analysis of about over 1,000 different studies and looked at 14 different correlates. Now, as you mentioned, the school, the primary through 12 and before and beyond, we start over here and we start with just this first one and go around in no sequential order, but we do start off with rigor of curriculum being what we found out to be the most influential or most important, one of the 14. Teacher preparation, as well as quality, teacher quality and preparation, teacher experience and attendance. When we say teacher quality and preparation, we're talking about getting a student who may be one semester out of undergraduate school and possibly not the most highly qualified person, no matter what institution that person went to, and end up teaching in some of the most needy environments. As well as teacher experience goes in with that preparation, but also teacher attendance. We find out that in this group, we also have the highest teacher dropout, stopout, failure to attend, and all those things in that age category as well. These teachers are also teaching in the most needy classroom environments. Class size, of course, if you have a class size of 1 to 13, let's say, we say that's a great ratio. But then if you have the teacher who has very few qualifications, working on permits that in a lot of times in areas like D.C., we have had half of the population of teachers in special education just this past year were working on emergency licensure, which means they really weren't qualified to even work in the area. Okay, moving along, technology-assisted instruction. You do have classrooms that have computers in the classroom, but when you look at them, either they do or they don't. And then if they do, are they connected to the internet? They are, they aren't. And if they are connected to the internet, do teachers know how to use those for instructional purposes rather than just wasting some time? And I don't mean wasting time, but I just mean not using it for to its fullest potential. And that's what we're finding in that area there. And then school safety, of course, speaks for itself in a lot of ways, but as related to the study today we're talking about, school safety comes in the feeling that students get from not being or being accused of acting a certain way, all right? And that becomes an issue when your educational outcome is based on how you looked or act. And then on the other side, before and beyond, so we're dealing with stuff before the child gets to school and also during the day after school in those areas there. And again, we'll go from parent participation, parent availability. One of these would be single-parent families, homes that have a working parent, not able to be there available for the child. Parent availability, parent participation, as well as being able to go to schools and getting involved, as well as not getting the information to become more involved in school activities and so on and so forth. Watching television, obviously these are some things when we do these research talks and presentations, we talk to the students, we talk to families, we talk to administrators, teachers, whoever will listen in terms of this whole process. TV watching. You'll see later on we have some information about how TV watching, how much, and what it does in terms of affecting the outcomes. Reading to young children at a certain age, we find out that there's a higher population of folks who actually read, and that may go back into parent availability. Student mobility, and we're not talking about fidgety, ADD, anything like that. We're talking about moving from school to school to school to district, or within the district, and a student being called gifted in one school, moved to a school across town, they lose his records and he's find himself in special education somehow. That's interesting to find that and work through it. And then last three, we're working with the medical area here, like a Vanderbilt Medical and folks who are interested in those areas. We're talking about things from lead poisoning, low birth weight, as well as hunger and nutrition. Some of our work we did this past summer with a group of young men, we found out that a lot of these guys, we had 60 or 70 young men in the room at one time and asked how many of them had eaten breakfast that morning, and I believe somewhere around 5 to 7 hands went up. Now, they were with us at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they were going to be with us until 12 or 1, and we were going to feed them at 11:30, 12, but they had not eaten yet. And I don't know how you are by noon if I hadn't eaten since last night, but I know it's not the most conducive feeling to be hungry and have 60 other guys, young guys, running around, and you're trying to give them some kind of heavy conversation. So hunger and nutrition was an issue, as well as leading to issues of low birth weight. Obviously, we're dealing with prenatal and a lot of these areas there. They're outside of the teacher's responsibility sometimes, classroom responsibilities, as well as faculty's responsibility. But how do we get the medical area into and get them involved with dealing with parents in terms of prenatal care, low birth weight, and dealing with those issues? Also, lead poisoning. We have a lot of homes still in existence today that still use lead-based paint and have issues of it. Now, one thing we found out from some of these research is that it does at least two things. One, lead increases violence, and two, it decreases tested IQ by at least 10 points.
And then a new study came out last week, not surprising, indicating that a significant number of children who have ADHD have a large percentage of lead in their system. So we have to, even if you're in special education, you know, continue to think about on this issue. So earlier, Dr. Whiting said that, you know, we don't have all the answers. We do have a lot of concerns and a lot of complaints. We don't have all the answers, but a lot of the answers are embedded in this diagram right here. So how can we, what can we do if we're in the medical profession, for example, in terms of looking at those three issues there, hunger, nutrition, birth weight, and lead poisoning? Somebody is doing research on low birth weight among African-American children and Latino children in this city, but are they thinking about it in the context of the achievement gap? All right. So that was a quick overview of the issues that we've been talking about because we really want to spend some time with the study. I passed around, as Dr. Whiting was talking, an instrument to you, a questionnaire, that has really four items on there. Something for you to think about from a personal and professional perspective. And we're just going to give you 5 minutes, and we're going to move on. The first question we want you to look at, and that was that single sheet that I passed around, is have you ever heard of the term, this is other than today, because we've just said it, right? So look back to yesterday. Have you ever heard of the term acting white? Yes or no? Ever heard of the term acting black? Yes or no? How many say heard of the term acting white? All right. What about acting black? Pardon me?
Things that would be synonymous to that.
Synonymous?
Yeah, things that would be similar.
Okay. What does the term acting white mean to you? What does it mean to you? And then also answer, what does the term acting black mean to you? Especially on a weekly basis, I hear of some African-American student, more than any other student, meaning Latino or Asian-American, what have you, being accused of acting white for doing well and other variables. So instead of having a panel here of students, we thought the next best thing would be to show you a video so that you can see how real this issue is. Then we'll debrief, and then we'll share our study with you, okay?
Yes, we're Virginia. Yeah.
People have looked at it across economic lines, in particular rural or first-generation family. Mm-hmm.
It looks very similar with like the, you know, this and who you're coming from and this whole demonizing the group mythology.
Right.
But it's the label that when you get to that uppity, which was what it was always called when I grew up, being uppity, it's like white, which makes it a whole different
takes it to another level of complication.
To me, it just indicates that there's always going to be segregation, and that any kind of integration between the two races is going to be kind of superficial, because, like, I've had black friends before, but they never really wanted to do anything outside of school. And maybe it's because from, like, their families or their friends' perspective, it's once they become friends with white people, then they start acting white. And even though they may like you, like the white person, you know, it's just...
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit more in the study. That piece about integration or racial density or what have you. All right, thanks.
I don't think it's just racial or economic either. I think there's a whole culture that is against excelling. Because I know when I went to school, and I see this in the high school where I work all the time, that I was accused of breaking the curve, and, you know, why do you have to do so well? You're making it harder for all the rest of us. You know, there was that pressure not to succeed. And so you have to have a pretty good... a pretty good self-concept and not caring what the peers think to fight against that. And I think that the students who do succeed, you know, are do really well are the ones that have learned to fight against that peer pressure not to succeed.
Did you have Anna?
I was just thinking about like counter examples, you know, where you have situations where certain economic groups are disadvantaged, but they don't form this opinion. Like, they form an opinion that's kind of opposite to that, more reactionary. Mm-hmm. Like, we must succeed. Mm-hmm. Even within the black community in the past, there was that idea that there should be at least among us some who will go forward, you know, and they would put the community energies into pushing those children into the forefront, which is kind of the opposite of what we're seeing.
We just found there's just a new newspaper, first version, sitting right outside. You might want to grab one on you out of the door. It's called The Talented Tenth. It reminds me of what you're talking about, because during the Du Boisian era, there was such thing as a certain group of blacks during that time who had opportunity, who came from the right families, or all that kind of stuff. Intelligentsia created that kind of that notion of this portion of folks will lead us to someplace else. 100 years past those ideas, however, it hasn't come to fruition in a lot of ways yet. There's always a point, counterpoint to all these arguments. When I heard here, what did you pick up the point when he said, made the words about the one student there who really kind of put on blast, if you will, just put him on right under the spotlight. He said, you know, basically, if you act this way, you get no love. You gets no love, is what he said. But if you think about that in terms of the chronological developmental stage in which these young folks are right there at that point in time, getting love versus getting a good grade, if you put those on the scale, they don't balance out. They don't balance out. One of my constructs in my scholar identity model deals with a need for achievement being greater, need for affiliation being greater than a need for achievement. And that becomes an issue. And if you go back to it, and I have this, when I just really running it, just talking it, if you say a person who's selling drugs, for example, now we say this is what you're doing to the community, to the person, you're killing the environment, stuff like that. But from his perspective, her perspective, I'm making money, I'm buying clothes, I'm buying the car I want, I'm getting the attention I want, I'm getting the love I want. I'm moving up, and if move middle class means more people appreciate me, I get love. So it goes right back to you gets no love, ultimately. It doesn't and make those things acceptable, but you can't understand it. So how do you attack that a lot earlier? That's one question we were asked talking about during the video was how do you, because a lot of information has to come from parents, family members, administrators, all the folks who have a role in that student's life. When Dr. Ford showed you the contiguous rings we have up there, concentric rings we have, those bring in the whole part of the individual, but they also bring in the whole community. As a church, minister, pastor, What is your role in this thing? Do we even talk about this thing? How do we engage these things? I can remember, we hate to digress, but we work together all the time, so we do this, she'll start flipping buttons in a second, and we'll move forward. But I remember during 19, I want to say this year correctly, because I believe it was about 1995, the Center for Disease out of Atlanta just came out with a new study on HIV and AIDS infected folks. It had just at that point transitioned, and the largest number reported were black women and African-American children. And that, I guess, I was just at that time in life where it was, I heard it loud and clear. And I went out to, and I said, okay, who has the most access to the most folks in the community? Churches. That's what I said in my head, churches. So I went out and I spoke to 15 or 17 of the local churches, black and white, didn't matter to me. And I went into there. Do you know only one church allowed me to talk to the folks? One. And it was only one group of people I could talk to, not the whole folks. And I wasn't charging for this, and I wasn't, it was just something that I had through the American Red Cross found out. So it was even, I had the information, but couldn't give it out to the folks who were there. So not dumping on churches. But what, other than the police force, when they come up behind you, do you feel comfortable or nervous? Me, personally, I still feel nervous.
Oh, I got a ticket the other day. I almost lost my
mind. You deserve it, though. I know her. She probably deserved it. But anyway, moving right along. Okay.
$84.
You got some love.
$84.
And the last one he said, was, what Spike Lee say? He said, if you don't get the education, you're going to be asked out. Now, that was one of those things. That, well, okay, did you hear him or didn't? If you heard him, but what does that actually mean? SOL, okay? You know, you're somewhat out of luck, okay? Yeah, that's what it basically means, that if you don't get those things, you are behind it, and you're very hard to catch up with it. So those are some of the messages and images we're trying to transmit. Yes, ma'am?
One more thing to add in terms of the education system.
Yes.
Especially when you get into smaller towns where you actually have the education system, you actually have the teachers saying, because you're black, I wouldn't expect you to achieve very much.
I do know.
Okay. And that's, that is a big thing because they're at home with you, but they're at school too.
Yes.
Okay, and they're being told by their friends, you know, you're acting white if you want to achieve, and they're being told by their teachers, you know, you're black so you can't achieve. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, it's pressures from everywhere. It's just like a circle.
Let me put this last thing on the ground. And this is reality, though. This is important because this is happening within the last 72 hours. Okay, so high-achieving young man comes to a school like Vanderbilt, makes it to his second year, and he's headed towards STEM type of classes. So that's science, technology, engineering, mathematics, those things, okay? Struggling through the first year, but makes it through, getting the second semester, and is conflicted about whether or not to pull his pants up and dress a certain way, act a certain way, and do what it takes to make it through that kind of rigor of a curriculum, or do I fit in? Subsequently, Friday night, I'm at the doorway because I get word from a third or fourth person that this person may be thinking about committing suicide. 18-year-old freshman on campus. So I'm having this conversation for a couple of hours, end up going to eat something, going to see a movie and stuff like that, getting my feel of it and trying to get the idea. So I'm seeing it now on the college level, a student who clearly wore the glasses with the tape around him most of his life, got kicked in the pants everywhere, but now he's over 6 foot something, he looks like an athlete, and then of course, there you go. You start thinking that that person is an athlete, you get love because you look this way. You're not getting it because you got that good grade. Matter of fact, getting that good grade means you can't go out there and get that love. So now you're tossing and turning about what do I do next? So in order to get love from somebody, you give them a scare. Well, if you don't hang out with me, I'm going to take all of these pills. So you tell that to this person. This person says, like Chicken Little, calls your parents, who call two more people, gets to me, I'm at your door. Okay? So it's real and exact. Like I said, it only takes one. Because if that one person OD'd on anything because of acting white, that whole system there, then it really makes a difference, doesn't it? I'm done. Go ahead.
Let's, we only have about half an hour. And we're going to skip a few slides. are growing up in a culture of anti-achievement or a culture of anti-intellectualism. Enough said about that. I do want to add, however, that I think, you know, a lot of kids get accused of being a nerd, a geek, this, that, and the other stuff. But for African Americans in particular, it seems to take its toll. To be called acting white is very different from being called a nerd or a geek. That cuts through the soul when someone says that to you. So you could be called a nerd and a geek, and you will still do well. You're like, oh, well. But when you're accused of acting white, it's like, how do the students react? And too many succumb to the accusation. The other statement we want to make is that culturally diverse students therefore face additional barriers to achievement, and these are less likely, these barriers are less likely to be faced by, in particular, white students. A third proposition is that we're unlikely to close the achievement gap and to increase students' achievement, meaning to reverse underachievement and low achievement, until we change the attitudes that diverse students have about themselves as learners, as African Americans, as Latino Americans, and just, you know, as scholars, period. All right. So in your respective role, whether you're here as a parent, whether you're here as a guardian, a mentor in the justice system, all right, as an educator, we need to be thinking about what we can do.
One thing, let me add something there real quickly. What we have to think about here is this colorblind comment down here. I just reviewed a book by Joe Lieberman. It's Colorblind. It's dealing with the two constructs of colorblind versus race conscious. Now, whether you want to be colorblind or not, students are definitely race conscious. So you can continue to run down that road by yourself if you want to, but they are very much conscious about who they are, the skin that they're in. And it doesn't have, does that appreciation of who they are as individuals have to negatively impact their levels of achievement? The answer is no.
And then that last bullet says that until we get rid of deficit thinking about African American and other students of color, we're not likely to improve their achievement, get them to love themselves as African Americans or Latino Americans. So that deficit thinking, which is a whole nother workshop or presentation, is alive and well.
When we think about Latin American and Latino and other students, we start looking at some of the theoretical orientations that we work from, the premises of theoretical orientations. And we have several, but I think we put six up here. And I'm just going to put them up there really quick for you, and then we'll talk about them. And we teach classes. I'm doing three courses this semester here at Vanderbilt. One's called Black Issues in Education. The other one is called Race, Sports, and American Culture. And I'm doing a research methods, a qualitative research methods class that deals with how to conduct research in multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-gendered situations. Books I'm using will be things like Qualitative Research for Feminist Researchers, for example. McAdoo and Pipes and some of these other areas who get into looking at how we look at the phenomena that I'm mentioning. So in here, we're looking at Ogbu, I mentioned earlier, talking about voluntary versus involuntary. One of the questions that Dr. Ford asked earlier was, were you told to come here, or did you come here because you wanted to? Because that makes a difference. It makes a difference. If you came here because somebody said you had to be here, then part of this is really ticking you off. And that's okay, because part of it is getting in, and that's great. Not because I said one of the limitations was not everybody's going to be happy. Another one was achievement attitude gap, okay? Mickelson, dealing with that gap we mentioned earlier, the achievement attitude, how do we actually bridge those two? There's many gaps that are there. Yeah. Go ahead, your mouth's open.
It would be an African-American student who says, I value education, I believe in education, I know it's important, but then doesn't study, doesn't do the homework, doesn't come to the after-school program for studying. So right attitude, but in what? Inappropriate, inadequate, inconsistent behavior. So powerful work by Rosa Mickelson.
Down here we have a cross racial identity, and we talk about an aggressions theory, and we talk about some of the stages, if you will. We use Malcolm X as one of our models when we talk about it, going through the stages from Malcolm Little to Detroit Red to Malcolm X to Malik El-Shabazz, and some of the transitions he made from racelessness to this race conscious to this race hate to this all-knowing, kind of accepting kind of a person. And we juxtapose him in a lot of ways to Martin Luther King for a lot of folks. So it really gets to be some kind of eye-opening, eye-popping experience for folks, because we realize that we've been educated even amongst the quote-unquote black leaders, miseducated in a lot of ways. So we take it back to balance those things.
And even when you look at, and I'm sorry you can't really see this, but but A. Way Boykin's work at Howard, who talks about Afrocentric cultural styles, when he talks about verve, V-E-R-V-E, that means energy, excitement, easily excitable. If a teacher doesn't understand that, there's going to be a culture clash. It talks about the oral tradition and a number of other variables. So again, we're arguing you cannot close the achievement gap unless teachers understand, or educators, families, community leaders, more fully Afrocentric cultural styles. And then, of course, the cultural styles of others. Claude Steele's work on stereotype threat is very informative for those of us interested in why African-American students, for example, are not doing well on tests. One other explanation is a heightened sense of test anxiety, where all you have to do is indicate that the test is a measure of intelligence or has some kind of long-term impact. It will get you into college or not. Then we shut down because we've been told so often that we're intellectually, cognitively inferior. And that's why it's so easy to succumb to the accusation that you're acting white. And then the final piece that we focus on is Fordham and Ogbu's work on acting white, in particular acting white as a Pyrrhic victory. And we've already delved into that a bit.
Right.
So from some historical perspective, you have to consider slavery and the impact of slavery on current conditions today. So when people look at the perhaps initial accusations of acting white, it was who was in the house and who was in the field. And I'll stop right there. Another consideration would be the Clark studies, the Dahl studies used to inform desegregation, Brown versus the Board of Education, where very young children were shown these dolls and which one is cute, which one is smart, which one is like you, and almost inevitably the black children chose dolls that were white, and these were black children, despite some of his flaws. And I don't know any study that's not flawed, but despite some of his flaws, that research had a powerful impact and informs us today about racial identity. Du Bois in 1903 talked about two warring souls and double consciousness, and is somewhat like what Aaron talked about earlier, a foot in two different worlds, and you feel schizophrenic. And especially when you get to a setting, and it doesn't have to just be school, but it could be church and it could be a business where you're not accepted because of the way you act, the way you dress, the way you talk, and sometimes it's not even your own fault. For example, that you speak non-standard English. Very capable, very intelligent, but you've not learned standard English. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, read in schools quite a bit, but just read some of his work and his quotes about being black as a day is long and totally ignored, rendered invisible, insignificant. Leonida McLean is somebody whose work I admired a lot when I was in graduate school. She was the first black person at the Chicago Tribune, and she actually ended up committing suicide because she could not reconcile this accusation that she was an exception to the rule. She got tired of hearing that she was exceptional and could not take the stress, and ended up committing suicide. In
83. She had what they ended up calling survivor's guilt.
Survivor's guilt, right.
It was kind of like leaving your men or women in the field of battle. You're the only one from your platoon who survived the bus over the hill, and you're the only one who fell out of the window before it went. How do you deal with coping that you're the only one who made it? And in this case, she's very successful in being reminded of it constantly, mm-hmm. and that was one of the contributing factors to her taking her life.
And Clarence Page, her husband or former husband, writes quite a bit about her life still today. But those are two of her works, A Foot in Each World and How Chicago Taught Me to Hate White People. And then the final one is McArdle and Young, who we think might have been the first person to actually really study this concept of acting white in 1970 in the American Journal of Psychiatry. Just some questions for you to think about. And it says other research, but we're going to skip the other research. It says, do peer pressures regarding achievement vary in different contexts? And people want to know, how does, for example, acting white vary when you are a low achiever? Will you be accused of acting white? For the most part, you're going to be accused of acting what? Black, not white. All right, income level. All right. Does it matter, you know, for those on free or reduced lunch versus not on free or reduced lunch, are you likely to be accused of acting white? What about SES? And we don't use those, Dr. Whiting and I don't use those terms interchangeably. Income is just income. What should your paycheck say? SES is about your educational level, your occupation, your income, your quality of life. So what is life like for someone who is in the upper income bracket, who is African-American, versus another income bracket? What about gender? Dr. Whiting has written extensively and consulting on the issue of gender. Does it vary? Do girls who are black get accused of acting white more than boys? What about younger children? When does this stuff start? And if you read Upchurch's book, John Upchurch, Convicted from the Womb, comes to mind in terms of a book. He said it starts almost, almost starts from birth, all right? But definitely we think we see it starting around second grade. So those of you who are teachers and parents, don't think that you need to wait. The kids are going to see it in middle school. They're going to see it in elementary school.
A lot of it, when we talk about, again, this is dealing with today, we looked at acting white, but we're going to talk about the high-achieving young
I'm stuff. Skipping this stuff.
High-achieving young, I'm going to talk about this in 5 minutes. So young-achieving students who do very well, we say we go back and forth. Anyway, so those young-achieving,
No!
You can't control anything anymore. Okay, those young achieving students who do very well, and they, I'm dealing with a four-year-old right now, my daughter, and I'm coming to understand that she has started to understand color somewhere in the range of 2 years old, somewhere around that color, differences in color, and things like that. And now that she's being bombarded in one of the schools with the notions of being the only one or a few of the ones, and then we start to take that ladder of understanding color as just beauty of color and different differences, and that ladder or that paradigm starts to switch to where we start rank ordering which colors are better than others. And then we start to put common sense, but we start to try to make sense out of why this one is better than others. Other than the minority status, the few folks in their status, there's no other explanation for it. But you can't explain that to a four-year-old who's trying to figure this thing out. So when we look at some of these things and we're talking about all these by school setting, all these questions come in. How do we look at them, specifically by race, by ethnic group? This is just some work pulled out of, this got cut off, it's on here. It is actually there, it's just cut off up here. Just need a little bit more of this. But pressure, to be sure. The popularity of white students increases as the grades increase for black and Hispanic students. It actually drops off, particularly at somewhere around the 2.5 range for Hispanics. It drops off almost to zero, if you see it. Right around 2.2 to 2.5, it drops off. And for black, somewhere around 3.2, it starts to drop off as well. And what they did a study of folks with GPAs in terms of friends, and they said, well, maybe they switched friends, and maybe they did. So we looked, the variables were actually looked at inside there, but what happened was your actual number, percentage-wise, actually dropped of those high-achieving students. So that what meant, ultimately what this meant was they were opting to keep their friends than to continue to achieve. And when we look at the white males, the higher their GPA went, the more friends they actually had. So it's in there. Other findings, at low GPAs, there's a little difference amongst ethnic groups, relationships, we see that. But when a student achieves 2.5, it starts to drop. Grades improve beyond this level, Hispanic students lose popularity. 3.5, continue to have loose friend. Experience of black and white students diverges as GPA grow higher. As we talk to our students continuously in the classrooms about going home that weekend, your friends that you had when you left high school, when you go home, how many friends do you still have? Constantly, continuously. Well, I don't talk to anybody. I have a cousin that I used to talk to. But almost continuously and on a higher level, the higher they go, the less friends they actually have at home. Family members, cousins, people who are related to them, brothers and sisters even. Okay? Acting white and popularity. Acting white is unique to those who were black students, comprise less than 80% of student population. In predominantly black schools, I find no evidence that at all getting good grades adversely affects student popularity. This work is done by Fryer, and it talks about the effect of acting white on popularity, and it's twice as large
and some, as it says, more integrated schools and less integrated schools. That would make sense, right? Popularity in private schools. For black and Hispanic students who attend private schools, I find no evidence of a trade-off between popularity and achievement. We have to think about that for a second. What does that say to you? What are you getting from that? Right. What culture of schools. What does it say when you have the reverse of that, when you have 50, 60, 70%, 80% minority schools, however, which tends to be the case? And in Indianapolis. In Nashville, it's no exception. Private schooling advantage, popularity of black students in private school, Hispanics. You're going to see actually as the GPA wanders about, as the students go with the GPA, private schools versus public schools, it drops down. Sorry for those who can't see it over here. But it actually, for private schools versus your popularity of black students in private schools, popularity of Hispanics in private schools, how it wanes. There is an effect that when you're amongst like-achieving students, it happens. So when you have these schools that are public education systems, schools, there tends to be a lot of accusations that have more systemic long-term effects. Now, I'm not advocating going to all private schools, by the way, because that was tried before. It's called segregation. Okay, Fryer, how important are these social pressures? Although the story has yet been fully told, in my view, the prevalence of acting white in schools with racially mixed students' bodies suggests that social pressures could go a long way towards explaining the large racial and ethnic gaps in SAT scores, the lack of underperformance of minorities in suburban schools, and the lack of adequate representation of black and Latino in elite colleges and universities. And it goes on with more, okay? So it talks about the importance of the social impacts of acting white, acting black. Now, there are other research that we're going to flip through right now, but what we're trying to do is give you that piece of, this is not just myself and Dr. Ford saying this is an issue, this is a problem. We want to bring a lot of research to you right now, but I'm going to fast forward some of these and just let you know that there are issues and work out there today that are covering these same areas, and basically from a more of a literary review or literature review in terms of action and doing something, very few of them go to that extent, okay? Perceptions of acting white, acting black, rather, amongst African-American teens, implications of racial, these are all issues, okay? Academic, scholastic, aesthetic, stylistic, behavioral, dispositional, impressionistic, all these are actually impacted when we start talking about the impact of acting black negatively, by the way. Acting black, this is one of the, this is a recent publication actually out, and College Identity and the Performance of Race. We're going to look at our study a little bit now because we have about 10 minutes and we're going to finish by 1:30. So Dr. Ford, you want to run with it a little bit?
Yeah. All right. This is a study that we did at this point with 928. We're going to go ahead and say culturally diverse students, although the school identifies them all as African American. Only 912 identify themselves as African Americans. All were identified as high potential. In other words, when we talked to the school personnel, we said we want students who are your top performing students to participate in this study. We have enough data. Well, not enough, but we have an overwhelming amount of data on black kids not doing well. We wanted to know what acting black and acting white look like to black kids who are doing well. So what does it say? 46% of these students were formally identified by their school district as gifted, and the other ones had GPAs at least 3 point and above. 8% were in AP classes. Of course, those would be high school students. And then 23% were in honors classes, again, high school students. And they were in 5 school districts. In terms of, we asked them not just questions about acting white and acting black, but we were looking at the work ethic, the achievement ethic. You know, that Mickelson piece about the discrepancy between attitude and behavior. So how much time do you study? How many books do you have at home? How much television do you watch? How many hours do you spend talking on the telephone? How many hours do you spend with your friends? You know, those kinds of things. And, you know, what are your hobbies? Sadly, only 7% of this highly capable population said that writing was a hobby. 16% said reading was a hobby. 24% said music, and 57% said sports. All right. But these are the highest performing. Think about the writing and the reading piece, okay? We asked them about media, number of books in the home, et cetera. Average of about 114 books, 90 CDs, 40 DVDs, and I think it says 20, what's that say down there? Video games. They spent an average of 11 hours watching television, 10 with friends, 10 listening to music, but go down to the bottom, only say 4 hours on personal reading and 3 hours on assigned reading. So they read when they're, you know, not much. So again, that discrepancy is there. And you have to say, now, if they are not really putting a lot of time into studying, why are their GPA so high? That's a whole nother conversation. It gets back to expectations and the quality and rigor of the curriculum. If they're in a curriculum in a school where there's not much teaching going on, I'm not surprised that they have A's and B, A and B averages. You understand what I'm saying? So they could be challenged even more. We asked them about effort. How much effort do you put forth in school? Would you rate your effort as high or low? And the majority of students did say that they rated their effort as high, but we had 25% here who were potentially gifted who said low, and then who were gifted who said low. So at 1/4 to 1/3 acknowledging that they are not exerting the effort that they need to or ought to. We, and this is really the essence of the study, asked some questions about acting white, acting black, and acting what we called unsmart. 40% reported being ridiculed or teased for doing well in school. And Aaron mentioned it earlier about who this teasing comes from. 31% from classmates, 25% from other students, 19% from those they would call their colleagues, 13% from family members. All right, so not as high as from classmates, but I fear if you're raised in a home where you're told you're acting white, and that's at 13%. 65% know someone who has been teased or ridiculed for doing well. And one of our interpretations for this is that, you know, machoism, willing to say somebody else has been teased, but you wouldn't dare acknowledge that you have. So in actuality, we think that the personal teasing is even much higher. You understand? Much higher than what they self-report. That's to save face. 86% have heard of acting white, and 81% have heard of acting black. In terms of what is acting white and what is acting black, comments as well.
Comments and questions as well. And we're going to actually add those right into this. Think about it for a second, what you wrote. And then look at the list.
Acting white, the number one response among these 928 students is being intelligent.
Academic books, being intelligent.
Acting two is achievement oriented. Students would say something like prep school uptight, care about school, teacher pleasers. All right. Speak standard English, number 3. Has white friends, number 4. And as the young lady said here, uppity, stuck up was number 5. And then there are other, you know, less numerous responses. All right. But intelligent is acting white. What is acting black?
I got one right here for you that says
ghetto.
What's number 1? Oh, ghetto.
Being ghetto, thuggish, a gangster, those things were number one responses for what is acting black. And your responses mirror these, by the way, not necessarily in terms of ranking, but just that they're there. Number 2, being dumb, stupid, unintelligent, ignorant, those kinds of words were used. Number 3 was speaking non-standard English, cursing, and I saw that on some of your list, cursing. All right. And then number 4 was dressing in urban gear, saggy clothes, baggy clothes. One thing we want to emphasize is that out of 928 students, I really cannot think of one student who said acting black was anything positive. And I dare say that when I finish looking at those responses over there, we might not see it either. See, now we have since revised this study. Instead of saying what is acting black and what is acting white, we now say what does it mean to you? And that's what we asked you. We didn't ask you what we thought somebody else meant. We said, what does acting black mean to you? Isn't that the way it was worded? What does acting white mean to you? Not what does it mean to someone else.
I have a different kind of one here. This one says, highly sociable person and large family. That could be a positive thing.
For acting black.
Yeah, for acting black. That's an outlier, so we just throw that
one. Okay. And you need to think about what you put on your list. All right. Again, these are high-achieving students. Look at these GPAs, 4, 4.9, 4.5, 4, 4.7. And all of these were ones who said effort was low except that one right there. That means female, 11th grade, 4-point GPA, high effort, and gifted. Acting white, you speak with proper diction and talk as though you have some sense. Intelligence, doing all of your work and doing what's expected. What is acting black? Talking in slang language, wearing clothing in a certain way, or acting like you're tough and bad. Now, this is the piece about the peer pressure. Why is it that the question was something like, why is it that students who could do well, African-American students who could do well, aren't doing well? And this young lady said, because they don't want their friends to make fun of them. To see all of their friends, I can't even read it because it's off the thing. What does it say? This one right there.
All of their friends, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Have to not do the work to fit in, all right? Lack of focus, discipline, their friends have a bad influence, they're lazy, refuse to do the homework, they're scared to raise the bar. I think it's because they are not challenged enough, and also they don't want their friends to think they're different, okay? The same comments over and over and over again, all right? They're probably scared of what others are going to think of them. They don't want to be different. Cafeteria. When we surveyed 300 teachers, you know, just like we just did with you, except we collected more demographic information, we asked them, acting black, acting white, mean to you. Their responses were identical in terms of top five, identical in terms of top four, but they added two others that we had not anticipated, and this was a primarily white audience. Number six was something to the effect that children, black kids who act white are controllable. I want you to let that sink in. Are controllable. And then number two, they said they play by American rules and American norms and American values. Now, what are the implications? I think those kids who are considered acting white by those teachers are on their way to gifted ed, probably. I can control them. They deserve, therefore, this privilege of being in our gifted programs, or at least I won't refer them for special ed. We might keep them in general ed, but I won't refer them for special ed. In other words, what you think in terms of what acting black is and what acting white is has a powerful impact on the decisions you make on behalf of children. Now, that's speaking from a teacher perspective, but it's the same thing from a family perspective, right? So if you are telling your kids, you think you're better than us, don't come in here speaking standard English, why do you always have a book in your hand? You know, why can't you just go back to who you are? You know, those kinds of things. Then what is the impact going to be on your children as well? How many are going to aspire to college? How many are going to try to get an AP in honor classes and do well? How many are going to feel like the young man Dr. Whiting talked about earlier, just feel conflicted, you know, not good enough, can't please anyone? So the implications, they're very, very powerful. Acting black is real, acting white is real, and your perception of acting black and acting white trickles down to students, no matter what your area. So then the last slide that we want to share is this one. And, you know, this is for you to think about recommendations. We truly, and Dr. Whiting and I tried to do this with the summer program called the Scholar Identity Institute for Black Males this past July, have to change the image that diverse students have of themselves as scholars, meaning as students. All right. And this means working against the media and other forces. They need the mentoring. They need the role modeling. They need conversations, real conversations, conversations that are not colorblind, so they can understand that they're going to face some pressures, and yet they can be resilient and bounce back. All right. We need to work with counselors and psychologists. And I'm not talking about saying the kids are mentally ill or unhealthy or those kinds of things, as much as counselors and psychologists usually have those skills to get you to have self-reflection, introspection. What would happen if we get 10 male students who are highly successful in a counseling group together to vent, to talk about their concerns, and then to also what? Have a cohort so they can respond in a more positive way. So coping strategy, conflict resolution, anger management. And then although we've really talked a lot about educators, because we do have them a lot, meaning what, from 8 to 3 or 7 to 3, we have the students, we clearly got to work with families. Dr. Whiting and I share the Acton White videos all across the United States. We go into schools, we go into homes, we go into churches, because parents need to start working with the children from birth to have a strong self-esteem, strong self-concept, strong racial identity. And actually, we're out of time.
But
and
before we go, though, I just want to add one more thing. Sitting over in the corner over there is a gentleman who helped work with the program this past summer, the Scholar Identity Institute. He's the director of the Black Cultural Center here at Vanderbilt. He's Dr. Frank Dobson. And he and I did a workshop two Saturdays ago over at Belmont with about 60 or 70 those young men we worked in the summer. Now we're working with them throughout the school year as part of the 100 Black Men of Middle Tennessee, the 100 Kings, and we work with these young men every other Saturday over at Belmont, and we're taking them and giving what we're considering a pre-Scholar Identity Institute, if you will, because what we're finding out was the intensity of what we were giving them during the summer was a little bit more than a lot of them were ready for and could handle. So we're dealing with issues, and we're trying to create constructive words to use other than anger management, although that's what we're getting at. Conflict resolution, although that's what we're getting at. We're trying to find different terminology around that, because when we say we have an anger management class for young black males, automatically it feeds into the stereotype of violent, angry, sexual, those, you know, the big three or four, if you will. So what we're trying to do is construct a new approach, if you will, or revise one that has been let go. We again, back to the beginning, we had some publicity that was put on about the work that we're doing here, and people have been I haven't been blogged before, but people have been blogging the article. So we've been reading those things and going back, and it says, well, this sounds familiar to something that so-and-so did in 2000. And I said, okay, so is that good or is that bad? I couldn't figure quite out what they were saying. And I said, well, let's just throw all the kids out of the school, and there's issues of KKK were in there. It was just really interesting that when you start talking about doing something for American citizens to help, clearly something that a lot of people lived and died for, that we could get so much backflack for even having a conversation about it. So it becomes very interesting for me, because I haven't been in that position before.
There's a sheet going around for you to put your email on. We created an achievement gap listserv, and we try to send out timely information on this issue. So if you'll give us your email, we'll add you to that listserv. We try not to bombard you with anything except stuff on the achievement gap. The next lecture or seminar is going to be November the 6th, which is a Monday at the same time.
My birthday, so you can bring a birthday gift.
Okay. And we need when the listservs comes to you, we need to hear from you about what it is you want to focus on for the next lecture series, and or, you know, in other words, where do we go from here? We already have somebody planned, international person, coming in November. I'm talking to Haycock, president of Education Trust.
December,
I'm sorry. Yeah. As well. All right, for the spring. So where do we go from here? And let's get to talking about that on the listserv. All right, and in the next meeting, November the 6th.
Yes.
All right, now I'll be around for a few minutes if you have any other comments.
I will too,
questions.
So if you have any questions. Hey, I want to thank you all for taking time out of your day. Appreciate it, really. Thank you.
Yeah.